"Alice?" Alice said at last, just when Clay had decided the girl wasn't going to reply at all. She sounded like a kid trying to answer what she fears may be a trick question in a class that's really too tough for her.
"My name is Alice Maxwell."
"Alice," the plump woman said, and her lips curved in a maternal smile as sweet as her look of interest. There was no reason that smile should have set Clay on edge more than he already was, but it did.
"That's a lovely name. It means blessed of God."
"Actually, ma'am, it means of the royalty, or regally born," Tom said. "Now, could you excuse us? The girl has just lost her mother today, and
we've all lost someone today, haven't we, Alice?"
the plump woman said without looking at Tom. She kept pace with Alice, her beauty shop curls bouncing with every step. Alice was eyeing her with a mixture of unease and fascination. Around them, others paced and sometimes hurried, and often plodded with their heads down, little more than wraiths in this unaccustomed darkness, and Clay still saw nobody young except for a few babies, a few toddlers, and Alice. No adolescents, because most adolescents had cell phones, like Pixie Light back at the Mr. Softy truck, or like his own son, who had a red Nextel with a ringtone from the Monster Club, and a teacher worker mommy who might be with him, or might be just about any—
"Stop it. Don't you let that rat out.
That rat can do nothing but run, bite, and chase its own tail." The plump woman, meanwhile, kept nodding. Her curls bounced along.
"Yes, we've all lost someone. But this is the time of the great tribulation. It's all in here, in Revelation."
She held up the book she was carrying, and of course it was a Bible. And now Clay thought he was getting a better look at the sparkle in the eyes behind the plump woman cat's eye glasses. That wasn't kindly interest. That was lunacy.
"Oh, that's it. Everybody out of the pool," Tom said.
In his voice, Clay heard a mixture of disgust at himself for letting the plump woman bore in and get close to begin with, quite likely, and dismay. The plump woman took no notice, of course. She had fixed Alice with her stare, and who was there to pull her away? The police were otherwise occupied, if there were any left. Here there were only the shocked and shuffling refugees, and they could care less about one elderly, crazy lady with a Bible and a beauty shop perm.
"The vial of insanity has been poured into the brains of the wicked, and the city of sin has been set afire by the cleansing torch of Jehovah," the plump lady cried.
She was wearing red lipstick. Her teeth were too even to be anything but old-fashioned dentures.
"Now you see the unrepentant flee, yea, verily, even as maggots flee the burst belly of—"
Alice put her hands over her ears.
"Make her stop," she cried.
And still the ghost shapes of the city's recent residents filed past, only a few sparing a dull, incurious glance before looking once more into the darkness, where somewhere ahead, New Hampshire lay. The plump woman was starting to work up a sweat, Bible raised, eyes blazing, beauty shop curls nodding and swaying.
"Take your hands down, girl, and hear the word of God before you let these men lead you away and fornicate with you in the open doorway of hell itself. For I saw a star blaze in the sky, and it was called Wormwood, and those that followed it followed upon Lucifer, and those that followed upon Lucifer walked downward into the furnace of—"
Clay hit her. He pulled the punch at the last second, but it was still a solid clip to the jaw, and he felt the impact travel all the way up to his shoulder. The plump woman's glasses rose off her pug nose and then settled back. Behind them, her eyes lost their glare and rolled up in their sockets. Her knees came unhinged, and she buckled, her Bible tumbling from her clenched fist. Alice, still looking stunned and horrified, nevertheless dropped her hands from her ears fast enough to catch the Bible, and Tom McCourt caught the woman under her arms. The punch and the two subsequent catches were so neatly done, they could have been choreographed. Clay was suddenly closer to undone than at any time since things had started going wrong. Why this should have been worse than the throat-biting teenage girl or the knife-wielding businessman, worse than finding Mr. Riccardi hanging from a light fixture with a bag over his head, he didn't know, but it was. He had kicked the knife-wielding businessman, Tom had too, but the knife-wielding businessman had been a different kind of crazy. The old lady with the beauty shop curls had just been a— Jesus, he said. She was just a nut, and I cold-cocked her. He was starting to shake. She was terrorizing a young girl who lost her mother today, Tom said, and Clay realized it wasn't calmness he heard in the small man's voice, but an extraordinary coldness. You did exactly the right thing. Besides, you can't keep an old iron horse like this down for long. She's coming around already. Help me get her over to the side of the road. Chapter 4. They had reached the part of Route 1, sometimes called the Miracle Mile, sometimes Sleaze Alley, where limited access highway yielded to a jostle of liquor marts, cut-rate clothing stores, sporting goods outlets, and eateries with names like Fuddruckers. Here the six lanes were littered, if not quite choked, with vehicles that had either been piled up or just abandoned when their operators panicked, tried their cell phones, and went insane. The refugees wove their various courses silently among the remains, reminding Clay Riddell more than a little of ants evacuating a hill that had been demolished by the careless passing bootstride of some heedless human. There was a green reflectorized sign reading, Malden, Salem Street Exit, 1/4 mile,
at the edge of a low pink building that had been broken into.
It was fronted by a jagged skirting of broken glass, and a battery-powered burglar alarm was even now in the tired last stages of running down. A glance at the dead sign on the roof was all Clay needed to tell him what had made the place a target in the aftermath of the day's disaster. Mr. Big's Giant Discount Liquor. He had one of the plump woman's arms, Tom had the other, and Alice supported the muttering woman's head as they eased her to a sitting position with her back against one of the exit sign's legs. Just as they got her down, the plump woman opened her eyes and looked at them dazedly. Tom snapped his finger in front of her eyes twice, briskly. She blinked, then turned her eyes to Clay.
"You hit me," she said.
Her fingers rose to touch the rapidly puffing spot on her jaw. "Yes, I'm sorry," Clay began. "He may be, but I'm not," Tom said. He spoke with that same cold briskness. "You were terrorizing our ward." The plump woman laughed softly, but tears were in her eyes.
"Ward? I've heard a lot of words for it, but never that one. As if I don't know what men like you want with a tender girl like this, especially in times like these. They repented not their fornications, nor their sodomies, nor their—"
"Shut up," Tom said, "or I'll hit you myself. And unlike my friend, who was, I think, lucky enough not to grow up among the holy Hannahs and thus does not recognize you for what you are, I won't pull my punch. Fair warning, one more word."
He held his fist before her eyes, and although Clay had already concluded that Tom was an educated man, civilized, and probably not much of a puncher under ordinary circumstances, he could not help feeling dismay at the sight of that small, tight fist, as if he were looking at an omen of the coming age. The plump lady looked and said nothing. One large tear spilled down her rouged cheek.
"That's enough, Tom. I'm okay," Alice said.
Tom dropped the plump lady's shopping bag of possessions into her lap. Clay hadn't even realized Tom had salvaged it. Then Tom took the Bible from Alice, picked up one of the plump lady's beringed hands, and smacked the Bible into it, spine first. He started away, then turned back.
"Tom, that's enough. Let's go," Clay said.
Tom ignored him. He bent toward the woman sitting with her back against the sign's leg. His hands were on his knees, and to Clay, the two of them, the plump, spectacled woman looking up, the small, spectacled man bending over with his hands on his knees, looked like figures in some lunatic's parody of the early illustrations from the Charles Dickens novels.
"Some advice, sister," Tom said. "The police will no longer protect you as they did when you and your self-righteous, holy rolling friends marched on the family planning centers or the Emily Cathcart Clinic in Waltham. That abortion mill," she spat,
and then raised her Bible as if to block a blow. Tom didn't hit her, but he was smiling grimly.
"I don't know about the vial of insanity, but there's certainly boku crazy making the rounds tonight. May I be clear? The lions are out of their cages, and you may well find that they'll eat the mouthy Christians first.
Somebody canceled your right of free speech around 3 o'clock this afternoon. Just a word to the wise. He looked from Alice to Clay, and Clay saw that the upper lip beneath the mustache was trembling slightly. Shall we go?
Yes, Clay said.
Wow,
Alice said, once they were walking toward the Salem Street ramp again, Mr. Big's giant discount liquor falling behind them.
You grew up with someone like that?
My mother and both of her sisters, Tom said. First New England Church of Christ the Redeemer. They took Jesus as their personal savior, and the church took them as its personal pigeons. Where's your mother now? Clay asked. Tom glanced at him briefly.
Heaven.
Unless they rooked her on that one, too. I'm pretty sure the bastards did. Chapter 5. Near the stop sign at the foot of the ramp, two men were fighting over a keg of beer. If forced to guess, Clay would have said it had probably been liberated from Mr. Big's giant discount liquor. Now it lay forgotten against the guardrails, dented and leaking foam, while the two men, both brawny and both bleeding, battered each other with their fists. Alice shrank against him, and Clay put his arm around her, but there was something almost reassuring about these brawlers. They were angry, enraged, but not crazy. Not like the people back in the city. One of them was bald and wearing a Celtics jacket. He hit the other a looping overhand blow that mashed his opponent's lips and knocked him flat. When the man in the Celtics jacket advanced on the downed man scrambled away, then got up, still backing off. He spat blood.
Take it, you fuck!
He yelled in a thick, weepy Boston accent.
Hope it chokes ya!
The bald man in the Celtics jacket made as if to charge him, and the other went running up the ramp toward Route 1. Celtics jacket started to bend down for his prize, registered Clay, Alice, and Tom, and straightened up again. It was 3-1. He had a black eye and blood was trickling down the side of his face from a badly torn earlobe, but Clay saw no fear in that face, although he had only the diminishing light of the Revere fire to go by. He thought his grandfather would have said the guy's Irish was up, and certainly that went with the big green shamrock on the back of his jacket.
The fuck you looking at?
He asked. Nothing. Just going by you, if that's all right, Tom said mildly. I live on Salem Street.
You can go to Salem Street or hell, far as I'm concerned,
the bald man in the Celtics jacket said.
Still a free country, isn't it?
Tonight, Clay said. Too free. The bald man thought it over and then laughed, a humorless double ha-ha.
The fuck happened? Any of yous know?
Alice said, It was the cell phones. They made people crazy. The bald man picked up the keg. He handled it easily, tipping it so the leak stopped.
Fucking things,
he said.
Never cared to own one. Roll over minutes, the fuck are those?
Clay didn't know. Tom might have. He'd owned a cell phone, so it seemed possible, but Tom said nothing. Probably didn't want to get into a long discussion with the bald man, and probably a good idea. Clay thought the bald man had some of the characteristics of an unexploded grenade.
City burning?
The bald man asked.
Is, isn't it?
Yes, Clay said. I don't think the Celtics will be playing at the Fleet this year.
They ain't shit anyway,
the man said.
Doc Rivers couldn't coach a pal team.
He stood watching them, the keg on his shoulder, blood running down the side of his face. Yet now he seemed peaceable enough, almost serene.
Go on, he said. But I wouldn't stay this close to the city for long. It's going to get worse before it gets better. There's going to be a lot more fires, for one thing. You think everybody who hightailed at Noth remembered to turn off the gas stove? I fucking doubt it.
The three of them started walking, then Alice stopped. She pointed to the keg.
Was that yours?
The bald man looked at her reasonably.
Ain't no was at times like this, sweetie pie. Ain't no was left. There's just now and maybe tomorrow. It's mine now. And if there's any left, it'll be mine maybe tomorrow. Go on now. The fuck out.
See ya, Clay said, and raised one hand.
Wouldn't want to be ya,
the bald man replied, unsmiling, but he raised his own hand in return.
They had passed the stop sign and were crossing to the far side of what Clay assumed was Salem Street when the bald man called after them again.
"Hey, handsome!"
Both Clay and Tom turned to look, then glanced at each other, amused. The bald guy with the keg was now only a dark shape on the rising ramp. He could have been a caveman carrying a club.
"Where are the loonies now?" the bald guy asked. "You're not going to tell me they're all dead, are you? 'Cause I don't fucking believe it."
"That's a very good question," Clay said.
"You're fucking A right it is. Watch out for the little sweetie pie there."
And without waiting for them to reply, the man who'd won the battle of the beer keg turned and merged with the shadows. Chapter 6.
"This is it," Tom said no more than 10 minutes later,
and the moon emerged from the rack of cloud and smoke that had obscured it for the last hour or so, as if the little man with the spectacles and the mustache had just given the celestial lighting director a cue. Its rays, silver now instead of that awful infected orange, illuminated a house that was either dark blue, green, or perhaps even gray. Without the streetlights to help, it was hard to tell for sure. What Clay could tell for sure was that the house was trim and handsome, although maybe not as big as your eye first insisted. The moonlight aided in that deception, but it was mostly caused by the way the steps rose from Tom McCourt's well-kept lawn to the only pillared porch on the street. There was a fieldstone chimney on the left. From above the porch, a dormer looked down on the street.
"Oh, Tom, it's beautiful,"
Alice said in a too rapturous voice. To Clay, she sounded exhausted and bordering on hysteria. He himself didn't think it beautiful, but it certainly looked like the home of a man who owned a cell phone and all the other 21st century bells and whistles. So did the rest of the houses on this part of Salem Street, and Clay doubted if many of the residents had had Tom's fantastic good luck. He looked around nervously. All the houses were dark, the power was out now, and they might have been deserted, except he seemed to feel eyes surveying them. The eyes of crazies? Phone crazies? He thought of Power Suit Woman and Pixie Light, of the lunatic in the gray pants and the shredded tie, the man in the business suit who had bitten the ear right off the side of the dog's head. He thought of the naked man jabbing the car aerials back and forth as he ran. No, surveying was not in the phone crazies' repertoire. They just came at you. But if there were normal people holed up in these houses, some of them anyway, where were the phone crazies? Clay didn't know.
"I don't know if I'd exactly call it beautiful," Tom said, "but it's still standing, and that's good enough for me. I'd pretty well made up my mind that we'd get here and find nothing but a smoking hole in the ground."
He reached in his pocket and brought out a slim ring of keys.
"Come on in. Be it ever so humble and all that."
They started up the walk and had gone no more than half a dozen steps when Alice cried,
"Wait!"
Clay wheeled around, feeling both alarm and exhaustion. He thought he was beginning to understand combat fatigue a little. Even his adrenaline felt tired. But no one was there. No phone crazies, no bald man with blood flowing down the side of his face from a shredded ear, not even a little old lady with the talkin' apocalypse blues. Just Alice, down on one knee at the place where Tom's walk left the sidewalk.
"What is it, honey?" Tom asked.
She stood up, and Clay saw she was holding a very small sneaker.
"It's a baby Nike," she said. "Do you?"
Tom shook his head. "I live alone, except for Rafe, that is. He thinks he's the king, but he's only the cat."
"Then who left it?"
She looked from Tom to Clay with wondering, tired eyes. Clay shook his head. "No telling, Alice. Might as well toss it." But Clay knew she would not. It was deja vu at its disorienting worst. She still held it in her hand, curled against her waist, as she went to stand behind Tom, who was on the steps, picking slowly through his keys in the scant light.
"Now we hear the cat," Clay thought. "Rafe."
And sure enough, there was the cat that had been Tom McCourt's salvation, wowing a greeting from inside. Chapter 7. Tom bent down, and Rafe, or Rafer, both short for Raphael, leaped into his arms, purring loudly and stretching his head up to sniff Tom's carefully trimmed mustache.
"Yeah, missed you too," Tom said. "All is forgiven, believe me."
He carried Rafer across the enclosed porch, stroking the top of his head. Alice followed. Clay came last, closing the door and turning the knob on the lock before catching up to the others.
"Follow along down to the kitchen," Tom said, when they were in the house proper.
There was a pleasant smell of furniture polish and, Clay thought, leather, a smell he associated with men living calm lives that did not necessarily include women.
"Second door on the right. Stay close. The hallway's wide and there's nothing on the floor, but there are tables on both sides, and it's as black as your hat, as I think you can see."
"So to speak," Clay said.
"Ha ha."
"Have you got flashlights?" Clay asked.
"Flashlights and a Coleman lantern that should be even better. But let's get in the kitchen first."
They followed him down the hallway, Alice walking between the two men. Clay could hear her breathing rapidly, trying not to let the unfamiliar surroundings freak her out, but of course it was hard. Hell, it was hard for him. Disorienting. It would have been better if there had been even a little light. But his knee bumped one of the tables Tom had mentioned, and something that sounded all too ready to break rattled like teeth. Clay steeled himself for the smash and for Alice's scream. That she would scream was almost a given. Then whatever it was, a vase or some knick-knack, decided to live a little longer and settled back into place. Still, it seemed like a very long walk before Tom said,
"Here, okay? Hard right."
The kitchen was nearly as black as the hall, and Clay had just a moment to think of all the things he was missing, and Tom must be missing more. A digital readout on the microwave oven, the hum of the fridge, maybe light from a neighboring house coming in through the window over the kitchen sink and making highlights on the faucet.
"Here's the table," Tom said. "Alice, I'm going to take your hand. Here's a chair, okay? I'm sorry if I sound like we're playing blind man's bluff."
"It's all right," she began, then gave a little scream that made Clay jump. His hand was on the haft of his knife, now he thought of it as his, before he even realized he'd reached for it.
"What?"
Tom asked sharply.
"What?"
"Nothing," she said. "Just nothing. The cat, his tail on my leg."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"It's all right."
"Stupid,"
she added with self-contempt that made Clay wince in the dark.
"No," he said. "Let up on yourself, Alice. It's been a tough day at the office."
"Tough day at the office," Alice repeated, and laughed in a way Clay didn't care for.
It reminded him of her voice when she'd called Tom's house beautiful. He thought, that's going to get away from her, and then what do I do? In the movies, the hysterical girl gets a slap across the chops, and it always brings her around, but in the movies you can see where she is. He didn't have to slap her, shake her, or hold her, which was what he probably would have tried first. She heard what was in her own voice, maybe, got hold of it, and bulldogged it down. First to a choked gargle, then to a gasp, then to quiet.
"Sit," Tom said. "You have to be tired. You too, Clay. I'll get us some light."
Clay felt for a chair and sat down to a table he could hardly see, although his eyes had to be fully adjusted to the dark by now. There was a whisper of something against his pants leg, there and gone. A low meow. Rafe.
"Hey, guess what?"
he said to the dim shape of the girl as Tom's footsteps receded. "Old Rafer just put a jump in me, too." Although he hadn't, not really.
"We have to forgive him," she said. "Without that cat, Tom would be just as crazy as the rest of them, and that would be a shame."
"It would."
"I'm so scared," she said. "Do you think it will get better tomorrow in the daylight? The being scared part?"
"I don't know."
"You must be worried sick about your wife and little boy."
Clay sighed and rubbed his face. "And the hard part is trying to come to grips with the helplessness. We're separated, you see, and..." He stopped and shook his head. He wouldn't have gone on if she hadn't reached out and taken his hand. Her fingers were firm and cool. "We separated in the spring.
We still live in the same little town, what my own mother would have called a grass marriage. My wife teaches at the elementary school. He leaned forward, trying to see her face in the dark. You want to know the hell of it? If this had happened a year ago, Johnny would have been with her. But this September, he made the jump to middle school, which is almost 5 miles away. I keep trying to figure if he would have been home when things went nuts. He and his friends ride the bus. I think he would have been home. And I think he would have gone right to her. Or pulled his cell phone out of his backpack and called her, the panic rat suggested merrily, and then bit. Clay felt himself tightening his fingers down on Alice's and made himself stop. But he couldn't stop the sweat from springing out on his face and arms. But you don't know, she said. No. My daddy runs a framing and print shop in Newton, she said. I'm sure he's all right. He's very self-reliant, but he'll be worried about me. Me and my, you know. Clay knew. I keep wondering what he did about supper, she said. I know that's crazy, but he can't cook a lick. Clay thought about asking if her father had a cell phone, and something told him not to. Instead, he asked, Are you doing all right for now? Yes, she said, and shrugged. What's happened to him has happened. I can't change it. He thought, I wish you hadn't said that. My kid has a cell phone. Did I tell you that? To his own ears, his voice sounded as harsh as a crow's caw. You did, actually, before we crossed the bridge. Sure, that's right. He was gnawing at his lower lip and made himself stop. But he didn't always keep it charged. Probably I told you that, too. Yes? I just have no way of knowing. The panic rat was out of its cage now, running and biting. Now both of her hands closed over both of his. He didn't want to give in to her comfort. It felt hard to let go of his grip on himself and give in to her comfort. But he did it, thinking she might need to give more than he needed to take. They were holding on that way, hands linked next to the pewter salt and pepper shakers on Tom McCord's little kitchen table, when Tom came back from the cellar with 4 flashlights and a Coleman lantern that was still in its box. Chapter 8. The Coleman gave off enough light to make the flashlights unnecessary. It was harsh and white, but Clay liked its brilliance, the way it drove away every single shadow save for their own and the cat's, which went leaping fantastically up the wall like a Halloween decoration cut from black crepe paper, into hiding. I think you should pull the curtains, Alice said. Tom was in the act of opening one of the plastic sacks from the Metropolitan Cafe, the ones with doggy bag on one side and people bag on the other. He stopped and looked at her curiously. Why? She shrugged and smiled. Clay thought it the strangest smile he'd ever seen on the face of a teenage girl. She'd cleaned the blood off her nose and chin, but there were dark, weary circles under her eyes. The Coleman lamp had bleached the rest of her face to a corpse-like pallor, and the smile, showing the tiniest twinkle of teeth between trembling lips from which all the lipstick had now departed, was disorienting in its adult artificiality. He thought Alice looked like a movie actress from the late 1940s playing a socialite on the verge of a nervous breakdown. She had the tiny sneaker in front of her on the table. She was spinning it with one finger. Each time she spun it, the laces flipped and clicked. Clay began to hope she would break soon. The longer she held up, the worse it would be when she finally let go. She had let some out, but not nearly enough. So far, he'd been the one to do most of the letting out. I don't think people should see we're in here, that's all, she said. She flicked the sneaker, what she had called a baby Nike. It spun. The laces flipped and clicked on Tom's highly polished table. I think it might be bad. Tom looked at Clay. She could be right, Clay said. I don't like us being the only lit-up house on the block, even if the light's at the back. Tom got up and closed the curtains over the sink without another word. There were 2 other windows in the kitchen, and he pulled those curtains, too. He started back to the table, then changed course and closed the door between the kitchen and the hall. Alice spun the baby Nike in front of her on the table. In the harsh, unsparing glow of the Coleman lantern, Clay could see it was pink and purple, colors only a child could love. Around it went,
The laces flew and clicked. Tom looked at it, frowning, as he sat down, and Clay thought,
"Tell her to take it off the table. Tell her she doesn't know where it's been, and you don't want it on your table. That should be enough to set her off, and then we can start getting this part out of the way. Tell her. I think she wants you to. I think that's why she's doing it."
But Tom only took sandwiches out of the bag, roast beef and cheese, ham and cheese, and doled them out. He got a pitcher of iced tea from the fridge. "Still cold as can be," he said, and then set down the remains of a package of raw hamburger for the cat. "He deserves it," he said, almost defensively. "Besides, it would only go over with the electricity out." There was a telephone hanging on the wall. Clay tried it, but it was really just a formality, and this time he didn't even get a dial tone. The thing was as dead as, well, as Power Suit Woman back there by Boston Common. He sat back down and worked on his sandwich. He was hungry, but didn't feel like eating. Alice put hers down after only 3 bites.
"I can't," she said. "Not now. I guess I'm too tired. I want to go to sleep. And I want to get out of this dress. I guess I can't wash up, not very well anyway. But I'd give anything to throw this fucking dress away. It stinks of sweat and blood."
She spun the sneaker. It twirled beside the crumpled paper with her barely touched sandwich lying on top of it.
"I can smell my mother on it, too. Her perfume."
For a moment, no one said anything. Clay was at a complete loss. He had a momentary picture of Alice, subtracted from her dress, in a white bra and panties, with her staring, hollowed-out eyes making her look like a paper doll. His artist's imagination, always facile and always obliging, added tabs at the shoulders and lower legs of the image. It was shocking not because it was sexy, but because it wasn't. In the distance, very faint, something exploded with a dim foomp. Tom broke the silence, and Clay blessed him for it.
"I'll bet a pair of my jeans would just about fit you if you rolled up the bottoms to make cuffs."
He stood up.
"You know what? I think you'd even look cute in him, like Huck Finn in the girls' school production of Big River. Come upstairs. I'm going to put out some clothes for you to wear in the morning, and you can spend the night in the guest room. I've got plenty of pajamas, a plague of pajamas. Do you want the Coleman?"
I guess just a flashlight would be okay. Are you sure?"
"Yes,"
he said. He took one flashlight and gave her another. He looked ready to say something about the small sneaker when she picked it up, then seemed to think better of it. What he said was,
"You can wash, too. There may not be a lot of water, but the taps will probably draw some, even with the power out, and I'm sure we can spare a basinful."
He looked over the top of her head at Clay.
"I always keep a case of bottled drinking water in the cellar, so we're not short there."
Clay nodded.
"Sleep well, Alice," he said.
"You too,"
she said vaguely, and then more vaguely still.
"Nice meeting you."
Tom opened the door for her. Their flashlights bobbed, and then the door shut again. Clay heard their footsteps on the stairs, then overhead. He heard running water. He waited for the chug of air in the pipes, but the flow of water stopped before the air started. A basinful, Tom had said, and that was what she'd gotten. Clay also had blood and dirt on him he wanted to wash off. He imagined Tom did, too. But he guessed there must be a bathroom on this floor, too. And if Tom was as neat about his personal habits as he was about his person, the water in the toilet bowl would be clean. And there was the water in the tank as well, of course. Rafer jumped up on Tom's chair and began washing his paws in the white light of the Coleman lantern. Even with the lantern's steady, low hiss, Clay could hear him purring. As far as Rafe was concerned, life was still cool. He thought of Alice twirling the small sneaker and wondered, almost idly, if it was possible for a 15-year-old girl to have a nervous breakdown.
"Don't be stupid," he told the cat. "Of course it is. It happens all the time. They make movies of the week about it."
Rafer looked at him with wise green eyes and went on licking his paw.
"Tell me more," those eyes seemed to say. "Were you beaten as a child? Did you have the sexual thoughts about your mother?"
"I can smell my mother on it. Her perfume.
Alice as a paper doll, with tabs sticking out of her shoulders and legs."
"Don't be silly," Rafer's green eyes seemed to say.
The tabs go on the clothes, not on the doll. What kind of artist are you?
The out-of-work kind, he said. Just shut up, why don't you? He closed his eyes, but that was worse. Now Rafer's green eyes floated disembodied in the dark, like the eyes of Lewis Carroll's Cheshire Cat. We're all mad here, dear Alice. And under the steady hiss of the Coleman lamp, he could still hear it purring.
Chapter 9. Tom was gone 15 minutes. When he came back, he brushed Rafe out of his chair without ceremony and took a large, convincing bite from his sandwich.
She's asleep, he said. Got into a pair of my pajamas while I waited in the hall, and then we dumped the dress in the trash together. I think she was out 40 seconds after her head hit the pillow. Throwing the dress away was what sealed the deal. I'm convinced of it.
A slight pause.
It did indeed smell bad.
While you were gone, Clay said, I nominated Rafe President of the United States. He was elected by acclamation.
Good, Tom said. Wise choice. Who voted?
Millions. Everyone's still sane. They sent in thought ballots. Clay made his eyes very wide and tapped his temple. I can read minds.
Tom's chewing stopped, then began again, but slowly.
You know, he said, under the circumstances, that's not really all that funny.
Clay sighed, sipped some iced tea, and made himself eat a little more of his sandwich. He told himself to think of it as body gasoline, if that was what it took to get it down.
No, probably not, sorry.
Tom tipped his own glass to him before drinking.
It's all right. I appreciate the effort.
Say, where's your portfolio?
I left it on the porch. I wanted both hands free while we negotiated Tom McCourt's hallway of death.
That's all right, then.
Listen, Clay, I'm sorry as hell about your family.
Don't be sorry yet, Clay said, a little harshly. There's nothing to be sorry about yet.
But I'm really glad I ran into you. That's all I wanted to say.
Same goes back, Clay said. I appreciate the quiet place to spend the night, and I'm sure Alice does too.
As long as Malden doesn't get loud and burn down around our ears.
Clay nodded, smiling a little.
As long as.
Did you get that creepy little shoe away from her?
No, she took it to bed with her like, I don't know, a teddy bear.
She'll be a lot better tomorrow if she sleeps through tonight.
Do you think she will?
No, Tom said. But if she wakes up scared, I'll spend the night with her. Crawl in with her, if that's what it takes. You know I'm safe with her, right?
Yes.
Clay knew that he would have been safe with her, too, but he understood what Tom was talking about.
I'm going to head north tomorrow morning as soon as it's light. It would probably be a good idea if you and Alice came with me.
Tom thought about this briefly, then asked, What about her father?
She says he's, quote, very self-reliant. Her biggest stated worry on his behalf was what he rolled himself for dinner. What I heard under that is that she isn't ready to know. Of course, we'll have to see how she feels about it, but I'd rather keep her with us, and I don't want to head west into those industrial towns.
You don't want to head west at all.
No, Clay admitted. He thought Tom might argue the point, but he didn't.
What about tonight? Do you think we should stand a watch?
Clay hadn't even considered this until now. He said, I don't know how much good it would do. If a crazed mob comes down Salem Street waving guns and torches, what can we do about it?
Go down cellar?
Clay thought it over. Going down cellar seemed awfully final to him, the bunker defense. But it was always possible the hypothetical crazed mob under discussion would think the house deserted and go sweeping by. Better than being slaughtered in the kitchen, he supposed. Maybe after watching Alice get gang-raped.
It won't come to that, he thought uneasily. You're getting lost among the hypotheticals, that's all. Freaking in the dark. It won't come to that.
Except Boston was burning to the ground behind them. Liquor stores were being looted, and men were beating each other bloody over aluminum kegs of beer. It had already come to that.
Tom, meanwhile, was watching him, letting him work it through, which meant that maybe Tom already had.
Rafe jumped into his lap. Tom put his sandwich down and stroked the cat's back.
Tell you what, Clay said. If you've got a couple of comforters I can bundle up in, why don't I spend the night out there on your porch? It's enclosed and it's darker than the street, which means that I'd likely see anyone coming long before they saw me watching, especially if the ones coming were phone crazies. They didn't impress me as being into stealth.
Nope, not the creep up on you type. What if people come from around and back? That's Lynn Avenue, just a block over.
Clay shrugged, trying to indicate that they couldn't defense against everything, or even very much, without saying so right out loud.
All right,
Tom said, after eating a little more of his sandwich and feeding a scrap of ham to Rafe. But you could come get me around 3. If Alice hasn't woken up by then, she might sleep right through.
Why don't we just see how it goes? Clay said. Listen, I think I know the answer to this, but you don't have a gun, do you?
No, Tom said. Not even a lonely can of mace.
He looked at his sandwich and then put it down. When he raised his eyes to Clay's, they were remarkably bleak. He spoke in a low voice, as people do when discussing secret things.
Do you remember what that cop said, just before he shot that crazy man?
Clay nodded. Hey, buddy, how you doing? I mean, what the haps? He would never forget it.
I knew it wasn't like in the movies, Tom said, but I never suspected the enormous power of it, or the suddenness. And the sound when the stuff from his head.
He leaned forward suddenly, one small hand curled to his mouth. The movement startled Rafer, and the cat leaped down. Tom made 3 low, muscular, irking sounds, and Clay steeled himself for the vomiting that was almost sure to follow. He could only hope he wouldn't start vomiting himself, but he thought he might. He knew he was close, only a feather tickle away. Because he knew what Tom was talking about. The gunshot, then the wet, ropey splatter on the cement. There was no vomiting. Tom got control of himself and looked up, eyes watering.
I'm sorry, he said. Shouldn't have gone there.
You don't need to be sorry.
I think if we're going to get through whatever's ahead, we'd better find a way to put our finer sensibilities on hold. I think that people who can't do that...
He stopped, then started again.
I think that people who can't do that...
He stopped a second time. The third time he was able to finish.
I think that people who can't do that may die.
They stared at each other in the white glare of the Coleman lamp. Chapter 10. Once we left the city, I didn't see anyone with a gun, Clay said. At first I wasn't really looking, and then I was.
You know why, don't you?
Except maybe for California, Massachusetts has got the toughest gun law in the country. Clay remembered seeing billboards proclaiming that at the state line a few years ago. Then they'd been replaced by one saying that if you got picked up for driving under the influence, you'd have to spend a night in jail. Tom said, if the cops find a concealed handgun in your car, meaning like in the glove compartment with your registration and insurance card, they can put you away for, I think, 7 years. Get stopped with a loaded rifle in your pickup, even in hunting season, and you can get slapped with a $10,000 fine and 2 years of community service. He picked up the remains of his sandwich, inspected it, put it back down again. You can own a handgun and keep it in your home if you're not a felon, but a license to carry? Maybe if you've got Father O'Malley of the Boys Club to co-sign, but maybe not even then. No guns might have saved some lives coming out of the city.
I agree with you completely, Tom said. Those 2 guys fighting over the keg of beer? Thank God neither of them had a .38.
Clay nodded. Tom rocked back in his chair, crossed his arms on his narrow chest, and looked around. His glasses glinted. The circle of light thrown by the Coleman lantern was brilliant, but small.
Right now, however, I wouldn't mind having a pistol, even after seeing the mess they make. And I consider myself a pacifist.
How long have you lived here, Tom?
Almost 12 years, long enough to see Malden go a long way down the road to Shittsville. It's not there yet, but boy, it's going.
Okay, so think about it. Which of your neighbors is apt to have a gun or guns in their house? Tom answered promptly.
Honey Nickerson, across the street and 3 houses up. NRA bumper sticker on his Camry, along with a couple of yellow ribbon decals and an old Bush Cheney sticker.
Goes without saying.
And 2 NRA stickers on his pickup, which he equips with a camper cap in November and takes hunting up in your part of the world.
And we're happy to have the revenue his out-of-state hunting license provides, Clay said. Let's break into his house tomorrow and take his guns. Tom McCourt looked at him as though he were mad. The man isn't as paranoid as some of those militia types out in Utah. I mean, he does live in Taxachusetts, but he's got one of those burglar alarm signs on his lawn that basically says, "Do you feel lucky, punk?" And I'm sure you must be familiar with the NRA's stated policy as to just when their guns will be taken away from them. I think it has something to do with prying their cold, dead fingers. That's the one. Clay leaned forward and stated what to him had been obvious from the moment they'd come down the ramp from Route 1. Malden was now just one more fucked-up town in the Unicel States of America, and that country was now out of service, off the hook, so sorry, please try your call again later. Salem Street was deserted. He had felt that as they approached. Hadn't he? No, bullshit. You felt watched. Really? And even if he had, was that the sort of intuition that could be relied upon, acted upon, after a day like this one? The idea was ridiculous.